Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Green Divas Radio Show. You're on with Green Diva Meg.
And Green Diva Lynn.
And we are freezing. I was going to say psyched, but freezing came out.
Yeah, it's making me groggy. If I'm cold, I get groggy.
Oh, don't get groggy, froggy. I know. It's lame. It's lame. But we have a pretty exciting show. They're all exciting, as you know. But this is a first for us, and you people will be treated to the first of our series.
Yes.
We're working with Greenpeace on a series of Greenpeace Green Diva segments.
I know. It's very exciting.
You know, I mean, because they really are sort of, I don't know, you know, they're one of the forerunners. They're one of the first organizations to really step up and become active for environment, right?
Right. So it's exciting to be working with them.
Yeah. And
helping them to get the word out here on the Green Divas Radio Show.
You know, and the interesting thing is we talked to their democracy team leader, Molly, mm-hmm. Molly.
Dorozensky.
Thank you very much.
Oh, no problemo.
And
what happened there? My words.
So Molly said, you know, this is unusual for them. And she thought it was interesting. And it was our first segment because this is a bit of a diversion from what they usually are, like really, really zeroed in on environmental issues and mm-hmm. action. But they really believe, and she explains how, you know, they said, well, why is climate change not happening fast enough? What's the bottleneck? And what's the problem? And part of the problem here in the U.S. is our current political and governmental structure.
Mm-hmm.
Democracy is broken here, and a lot of it has...
It moves like molasses.
Well, if it moves at all.
If it moves at all.
You know, and a lot of it has to do with money in politics, and, mm-hmm. You know, really it's not a partisan issue. It's an issue about democracy, so it doesn't matter where you fall on the political spectrum, this should be an issue that you want to hear about. And so they have a call to action to help fix democracy. So you got to listen to that segment.
And take action, for sure.
Yeah.
We'll have a post and a link to that action.
Yes,
as well.
We will. Yes, we will. So our feature this week is with, you connected with Michael Nash, the filmmaker?
Yes. The filmmaker for the climate refugees.
I just was like heartbroken watching the trailer. I didn't get a chance to see the full film, but the trailer is, you know, his goal was to put a face on climate change and make it real for people, that there are people whose lives have been dramatically altered because of climate change. This is real. This isn't just a theory about icebergs melting anymore.
Right. And it took him, what, 3 years to make it?
Yeah, and I think they're working now on an updated, I don't know if it's an updated version or a next film about this issue, but they're working on that. And so he's an interesting guy. That's a feature that
yeah, I can't wait to hear that.
Not going to want to miss. Foodie File with our Giselle Achazar about sustainable seafood. Achazar, yeah. Mm-hmm. sorry, Giselle.
And then we have Heidi Huttner. Dr. Heidi Huttner, talking about ecofeminism.
Yeah, which, I had a couple of really interesting, inspired conversations with her.
Mm-hmm.
And, this is the first of them. So, yeah, lots going on there. And what's going on in Chicago there, Lynn?
Well, we're just trying to stay warm, pretty much.
I know. I want to complain about the
cold. It's hibernation time.
And then I realize I'm talking to Lynn where it's like 20 degrees colder than anywhere. You know?
Well, I guess not today. I think we're about the same temperature. I ran out there today in a 7-degree wind chill. I've run it in weather as cold as 10 below. Actually, one time I ran when it was 20 below, but I decided I wasn't going to do that again.
That's extreme.
Yeah, it was. I had read about somebody else doing it. You know, people do it. And I thought, well, if these people can do it, why not me?
Why not?
And then I learned, why not me?
Yeah, you don't have enough meat on those bones, girl.
Well, it was more the icicles on my eyelashes that were a problem.
I'm sorry.
I was, like, trying to see, and all I could see were icicles.
That's kind of scary.
Yeah, it was weird. But yeah. 10 below is okay.
Yeah, all right. Well, in the meanwhile, I'm hoping people will catch up with us on social media because Lynn is ever busy, you know, interacting with y'all out there. So, you know, chime in.
Yeah, we're on Twitter, Instagram, Pinterest, YouTube, Facebook, of course.
All of it, right?
Where aren't we?
Exactly. I guess on Twitter, at The Green Divas. Same thing with Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
Look us up on Facebook. And, of course, there's GDGD Radio, just to confuse things. But, you know, we're there. We're out there.
And get the GDGD Radio app if you're looking for something else to do.
Yeah, because it's free and it's fun. And we have new programming every week. There's new stuff going up. And there's always something happening on GDGD Radio.
Hey, you got that right.
You know? All right. Well, what do you say we let these people listen to some of this great content we got for them?
Sounds good. Peace out.
All right. Peace out, folks.
The Green Divas love food. Organic, local, fresh, whole, delicious food. Here now is another Green Diva foodie file.
Well, it's been a while since we spoke to this wonderfully spicy Green Diva and, among other things, Giselle Achikar is the Icorico from Icorico TV. She's a chef. She's many things, a marketing executive, but she's all about healthy food and she's a lot of fun. Hi, Giselle.
Hi, Megan. How are you? Nice to be on again.
Yeah, I miss you. So I'm really glad we're going to get a chance to chat. And you've got some stuff to talk about when it comes to seafood.
I do. You know, yes, thank you for that introduction. Icorico is all about healthy food and lifestyle con sabor. And you can find Icorico TV on YouTube. You can find it at IcoricoTV.com.
Yes.
We're all over the place. And
on the Green Divas from time to time.
Yes, and on the Green Divas. And also with the NRDC's Voces Verdes, which I have been honored by being one of their top 50 Green Latino leaders in the U.S.
Nice.
And so I do a lot of speaking about environmental advocacy. And today we are going to be talking about something happening in our seafood production, which involves sodium tripolyphosphate, or STPP, a neurotoxin. Isn't that appetizing?
No. What? It's not. It's not okay.
It's disgusting, frankly, and yeah. It can kill us all. But what's interesting is, you know, a lot of people in the conversation about seafood are always talking about farmed versus wild caught. Really, that's not necessarily the question. You do want to ask that question.
Right.
But what you really want to ask is this particular seafood sustainably farmed?
Yes.
Right? Does the harvesting of that seafood destroy the ecosystems around it?
Right.
That's what's really important when we're talking about buying seafood. Domestic versus imported, super important. You know, the U.S. has much stricter seafood production policies than any other country around. And so when we think about imported seafood, we really want to talk about what's actually happening when they harvest the seafood and when they freeze it, right?
Right.
And what's happening is they're coating all of our seafood, fish, crustaceans, et cetera, with something called sodium tripolyphosphate, or STPP, in order to retain moisture in the seafood, quote unquote, right?
Oh, okay. And why?
Mm-hmm,
what?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's pretty gross. But getting back to the whole topic about sustainable seafood, right? Sustainable seafood, let's just kind of define what we're talking about. It's from sources, whether fish or farmed, that can maintain or increase the production long term without jeopardizing the ecosystem. So it's all
right.
About the ecosystem, right?
Well, it's the ecosystem, and it's also about, you know, maintaining a proper level of the fish supply so they're not overfishing.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's part of the health of an ecosystem,
yeah,
right?
But, right,
if
exactly.
Exactly, right? If we destroy what's going on in the ecosystem top to bottom, from algae to, you know, from bottom feeders to top feeders,
right.
From small to large, then we have unbalanced the entire system, and there are always going to be repercussions, right?
Yep.
We're seeing that now with overfishing and non-indigenous populations taking over areas and things like that, and then what happens to those ecosystems. So today we're going to talk about the number one most eaten seafood in the United States, shrimp.
Oh, yeah.
Do you eat shrimp?
No, I do not. I do not. So I'm thankfully.
And why not?
I just don't. I don't eat a lot of fish. I have a very limited – I'm mostly a vegetarian, for one thing.
Okay. So I eat fish and fowl. I'm not a red meat eater. But when I do have seafood, I have it for, you know, protein and taste and all
right.
of those things. And I think that's shrimp in particular is something that is eaten broadly across the United States.
Yes, I know it is.
Mm-hmm. And people should be quite discerning when it comes to eating shrimp for
Apparently.
Many reasons.
Yeah.
And one of them is because of the way that they are produced, right? They are what we're talking about, which is coated in and frozen in sodium tripolyphosphate. And you might want to say, well, what in the heck is sodium tripolyphosphate?
Right.
What? And what is it? It's a type of salt source. It's a colorless salt that's used primarily in laundry detergent.
Oh, all right. That's already not making me happy.
Lovely, right?
Yeah.
As my 10-year-old would say, Mom, grody to the max.
Yeah, grody.
So I'm going to read you something. I have a quote here, and I got this from the U.S. Patent Office application in 1981 for the patent on sodium tripolyphosphate. This is a quote. Fresh shrimp are stored in flake or crushed ice containing a moisture-binding phosphate from the time that they are harvested until they are processed, including both aboard the fishing vessel and in the processing plant, unquote. That is how they use sodium tripolyphosphate.
Okay.
And you might want to know what does that look like, really?
Yeah.
And I found a book called Bottom Feeder, How to Eat Ethically in a World of Vanishing Seafood by Teres Gresco. And I was looking at what happens when they when they're harvesting shrimp, you know, how they're growing it.
Yeah.
They do it in a shrimp pond, right? And what they do is they prepare the pond by spreading urea and superphosphate to encourage plankton growth because that's what shrimp eat, right?
Yeah.
And then they fill the pond with a brackish water, which is usually pumped from a nearby creek, and it's covered with diesel oil to kill off any insect larvae.
Oh, all right. That's...
And then the water is treated with something called piscicide, which is a substance that poisons any competing aquatic life, right?
Oh.
And then, and by the way, piscicide has been linked to Parkinson's disease.
Oh, dear. Yes. No. Mm-mm.
Exactly.
Not okay.
And then as the shrimp are grown, right, they are soaked in a solution of sodium tripolyphosphate, which is a neurotoxin, which is still legal in the United States, and it prevents the seafood from drying out in transit, and it also, because it's a salt, it boosts the production weight, right? It makes them fat. It swells them up because
they're retaining water.
It's retaining moisture. They're retaining water, right? So from start to finish, this entire process is truly disgusting.
Yeah.
So then I went to the FDA site because I was like, well, wait a second. This is, like, legal, right? And I went to the U.S. Food, the FDA, right? The FDA.
Yeah.
And I went to the Code of Federal Regulations, Title 21, and I found the following about substances generally recognized as safe, quote-unquote, quote, in Part 182.1810, sodium tripolyphosphate, which it says this substance is generally recognized as safe when used in accordance with good manufacturing practice.
Oh, no.
And I guess that good manufacturing process includes, you know, what's happening with piscicide and oil and these shrimp ponds. I mean,
yeah, that's really like, subjective there, isn't it?
Yeah, it's actually quite distasteful. So
is there such a thing as, you know, sort of sustainably, like, produced organic safe shrimp certified somehow? How do you know?
Yes, there are actually. So thank you for asking.
Uh-huh.
So there are two places that I go to when I'm looking at safe, sustainably sourced seafood. I go to fishwise.org, and then, of course, we all know we all know and love, the Monterey Bay Aquarium, seafoodwatch.org.
Right.
And if you go to seafoodwatch.org and you research shrimp, right, you put in shrimp, you search shrimp, and they come up with what are the best things. There are certified shrimp.
Okay.
There are certified shrimp. There are shrimp that, of course, are the best choice.
Right.
And most all of them that you're going to find are, of course, going to be from Alaska, Canada, and domestically the United States.
Yep.
There will be some from South America, but the truth of the matter is that if you want to truly be safe, you want to get domestic domestic shrimp. Now, the ones that if you go through the list and you find everything to avoid, every single last one of the shrimp are imported, all of them. All of them.
Wow.
So I cannot stress enough how important it is. Remember, I started with this very first question, domestic versus imported.
Yeah.
You never want to buy fish or, you know, particularly shrimp that's imported. And frankly, I just say that about fish in general.
Yeah.
When I go shopping for shrimp for my, I mean, or for seafood for my family, I always buy it domestically.
Yeah.
And then I'm careful to source it from the Pacific.
Yeah.
Because I know it's going to be safer. And frankly, what I always do is if I have a choice, I always buy wild-caught Alaskan seafood.
Yeah, yeah.
Which begs the question of, oh, really, are we going to do Arctic drilling in Alaska? Well, let's hope not, because what's going to happen to all of our best choice alternatives for seafood?
Wow. Well, this was a very informative podcast segment, my head's spinning. I know that there's a lot more to research about this, but people, please take note and pay attention. And I'm sure we'll have a post about this, and probably we'll even have a video or two from Giselle.
You are definitely going to have them. You're going to have a video from me that is titled "Buy Domestic Seafood."
Well, there you go.
And I will have that also in a blog post for them. But you know, the Buy Domestic Seafood video is 2 minutes. It gives you all this information. So if you missed anything that I've been talking about and where to go, you can find it in those videos, which, of course, you can find on YouTube at Ecorico TV, E-C-O-R-I-C-O TV. And you will have also, I will provide you links to yummy seafood recipes.
There you
You can do everything from salmon curry to super tangy, yummy Mediterranean shrimp, which is super yummy.
Nice.
And as always, you know I'm here to serve.
All right. Talk to you soon. Thanks, Giselle.
Thanks so much, Megan.
Hope you're hungry. For more easy and delicious recipes and even more foodie information, go to thegreendivas.com. That's greendivas.com.
Imagine an iceberg about the size of Chicago on a collision course with, well, it sounds like something out of a Hollywood movie, but this is a different kind of blockbuster. More after this.
Everyone wants to be a part of the green movement, and that's a great thing. Going green takes on a whole new meaning when you add tall grass beef to your family's dinner table. It's tender and juicy, and since the cattle graze on the natural grasslands of Kansas, it's also loaded with essential fatty acids and omega-3s that regular grain-fed beef lacks. It's good for you and your family, and good for the earth. For more information and to order tall grass beef online, go to www.tallgrassbeef.com.
A gigantic iceberg, larger than the city of Chicago, broke off Antarctica's Pine Island Glacier recently and is now floating freely in the Amundsen Sea, according to a team of German scientists. The massive sheet of ice measures about 278 square miles and broke away from the glacier, which is the longest and fastest changing on the West Arctic ice sheet. Scientists conclude that it's the water under the ice that's getting warmer and is causing it to break off. With larger icebergs melting, the sea level begins to rise, and in time might give a whole new meaning to the term beachfront property. I'm Bill Curtis. Earth Matters.
There are people in this world that just sparkle with an almost magical and radiant energy, leaving a wake of good stuff wherever they go. We just love meeting and talking with these folks who inspire us to be better do better. Wow, this is going to be a juicy conversation, which should be hours, but we will pare it down to actually two different Green Divas-inspired segments with the amazing, busy, and powerful Dr. Heidi Huttner. She is, among other things, she's an academic, she's a dean, she's an author, an advocate. I'm reading my handwriting. Advocate. she's got a couple of really interesting book titles out there: "Inspiring Green Minds: Memoirs of an Eco Professor," and the other one was "Nowhere: An Atomic Memoir." Both, among other things, many other things. But hi, Heidi. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks. It's really I'm very pleased to be talking to you today. I should just clarify in the books. Those are books I'm working on. They're not out there yet.
Well, they will be.
Soon be. Yes. And I do write on those subjects all the time, but in articles and that kind of thing. But those I have other books, but those two books are coming out.
Well,
not
they're
out yet.
Great. Then we will look forward to it, and they are certainly relevant.
Thanks.
Among all the other work that you do, and the TED Talk, which I want to encourage people to look for because it was a very powerful TED Talk. They all are, but you know, some more than others. And I resonated quite a bit. What you spoke with resonated with me quite
right.
a bit.
Right.
And I think our audience as well. So I woven into the TED Talk, which I'm sure is a really concise synopsis of a lot of the work that you're doing, you talk about ecofeminism. And I wanted to kind of get you to define that for us and what that means to you.
To me, well, it's a complicated term. It's a hard one to pin down in a very short conversation. But I'll give you my sense of why I use that term and what I do with ecofeminism. So I see that the way and ecofeminist philosophers argue this, that the same ways in which we exploit the earth and we colonize it and appropriate it and control it and dominate it and all those things, that's the same way in which women have been treated historically.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is a very well-known ecofeminist philosopher who calls the oppression of women and the oppression of the environment twin oppressions. So they work in parallel to each other.
Interesting.
And I've done a lot of historical work on it, and I won't go into all that right now. But if you even go back to, you know, early colonizers coming to, you know, to America and discovering it, and the way in which they would talk about the land, and the way in which they would talk about, for instance, Native American women, same language, same ways of looking, you know, objects to be appropriated,
right.
exploited,
right.
all those things. So, and that continues to this day.
Yeah, well, and you know, what sprang to my mind just from the term, and I'm not educated in this particular topic very well, or classically or whatever, I've been working a lot and learning a lot about Indigenous women in particular.
Right.
And how women, and Indigenous women in particular, are on the front lines of not only climate change impact, but in activism for change.
Right, right. And there's a history of that, a really strong history. And I talk about that in my TED Talk, that my own mother was an environmental activist and in the 1950s and had, and 60s and 70s and 80s, but there was a really powerful story I tell, which I'll let listeners go listen to that.
Yes, it is powerful.
It is powerful, and I discovered in my work also there's just this legacy of incredibly important women, scientists, activists, lawyers, advocates, who have really fought on behalf of protecting the Earth over the last few decades and made significant strides. Someone like, you know, Rachel Carson,
yes.
who's considered the mother of the American environmental movement. So there's that piece too, and then there's the piece of women being most adversely or negatively impacted by climate change in many, many places on the earth, especially in poorer communities, underdeveloped nations. Women are the ones who suffer most adversely from climate change. So that's another significant issue. And their voices are least heard. Their voices are, they have the least powerful voices in politics and in places where they can affect change to help themselves, and least access to education and all sorts of things. So there's that part, which is really key to ecofeminism as well.
And I know that this is a topic that I think you specifically teach on. So for those of us that are not in school, we're fortunate enough to be in school with you.
Right.
What would you recommend that they perhaps read or what kind of media they might be looking at to get a better sense of this?
Well, in media, you know, that's a really interesting question, because most of the media, well, I'm in a lot of women writers groups, and we always talk about the fact that the media and news is actually very male-dominated.
Yeah.
So that's a really good question.
Well, there's always the Green Divas.
Yes, there's Green Divas, and there's I have an article that just came out actually in Garnett News, a brand new news site that's for, you know, powered by women.
They say. Cool.
It's very new. Of course, there's Ms. I have an article in the Summer Ms. on radiation and women. In fact, there's another feminist issue, which is that women, little known fact, women are twice as likely to get cancer and almost twice as likely to die from it from the same exposure to radiation as men.
Yeah, I'm interested.
So That is not little known fact, and that's in an article I wrote at Ms. The Summer in print.
So something about our bodies makes us a little bit more vulnerable to radiation?
Scientists don't really know why this is, and it hasn't really been studied fully. And it's something that was pulled out by Mary Olson, who does really good work for an organization called NIRS, N-I-R-S, and also by Arjun Mukhajani, who's has another and really important organization, which the name is slipping me at the moment, but you can Google him, and he's also throughout my article. You can find him. He works on radiation issues and environmental justice. He's based in D.C. So both of them extracted information from studies larger study that was done, and out of that they found this sort of little and not much advertised fact that women are twice as likely as men, and the problem is that regulations are based on safety standards for a white male adult body. So that means that women might be in the workplace where it's considered acceptable according to a standard that's really not for them.
Right.
And girls, little girls, are seven times more likely to develop cancer from that same exposure as an adult white male, and little boys five times.
Huh.
So we know our most vulnerable are little girls and female fetuses.
Oh.
Right. So there's another ecofeminist fact for you. There's all kinds of ways in which, and I mean, I think the biggest piece is that, you know, we know women don't have as much power in political positions and in business and in places of power, right?
Right.
So that affects environmental decisions, and that affects our bodies and our health and our future and the future of our planet. These decisions are being made by one half of the population.
Well, and that does lead to what's going to be our next segment together, a discussion on eco grief, which it's sort of sitting with that reality that, you know, there are some serious problems and issues. And I guess one has to really kind of take the blinders off, as you talk about. Take the blinders off and sit with that until you are moved to act, because you will be. You cannot be. And you seem like you're an extremely busy activist in many ways. In your format and as a teacher and academic writer and speaker. And really.
And I also get out and march and petition and participate in all kinds of, you know, I mean, not as much as I would if that's. I didn't have all these other jobs I was doing, but certainly in my work itself, I'm definitely consider myself an advocate.
So I'm going to recommend that people in the meantime go to Heidi Huttner, HUTNER.com, and you can see and have links to some of her talks, her articles, books, and some of the things that she's active with. And I, for one, am looking forward to learning more.
Thank you. And I just wanted to just add that you had asked me about things to read. On my website, I have lots of information for people, because people are always asking me questions, you know, that maybe right. don't know a lot about particular environmental issues, but they also want reading lists, like you were just asking.
Yeah.
So I have extensive reading lists, extensive film lists, and lots of information at my website.
See? I told you. Go to HeidiHuttner.com, and then, of course, we'll share a lot more on The Green Divas after. Thank you, Heidi. We hope to talk to you soon.
Oh, thank you, Megan. I'm so honored to have been on your show.
We hope you're feeling the sparkle. Go out there and light up the world. As Dante said, even a little spark may burst a flame. For more inspiration, visit thegreendivas.com and listen for this and other shows on ggdradio.com.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. About 7 years ago, the U.S. Navy left port on a new mission to increase the use of renewable power and cut energy consumption in half by 2020. So the Navy is switching to clean fuel and making ships more efficient. But Elke Weber at Columbia University says top-down approaches will only go so far. Meeting the goal will also require behavioral changes on land and at sea. And since some of the changes will go well beyond efforts to turn off lights and computers, Weber says risks and benefits need to be clearly explained. For example, at first sailors might be hesitant to try a solar blanket that can be used to recharge batteries because it won't work without sunlight. But it has two advantages over a fuel-powered generator.
The generators actually hum, and it's not good to be in the field in enemy territory with something that hums because it makes you a sitting duck. The other thing is when you get hit by enemy fire and you have a fuel generator, it explodes. You know? It kills you, it kills people around you.
A solar blanket, however, won't explode and can continue to generate power if just a piece of it gets hit. So to convince sailors to adopt new technologies and practices, Weber says it's important to explain how they can save both energy and lives. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Care about the environment and social justice? Stay tuned as Green Divas and Green Dudes from Greenpeace, you know, those folks on the front lines of environmental activism, report on the hottest eco issues and ways you can take action. Ooh, this is really, really exciting for me. This is our first in our series, in our new segment series, Green with Greenpeace. I don't even think we actually have a name for it. It's just like Greenpeace. They're so darn cool. Green Divas and Green Dudes really doing good. Anyway, today we're going to be talking with Molly Dorzensky, who is the Democracy Team leader. Hi, Molly.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, I love this topic idea. We were bouncing around a couple of different topics for our first segment with y'all, and there are so many. But this really is so important as we're going into our political nightmare season. And why don't you talk about the pledge to fix democracy, what that means, and what we're asking candidates to do.
Sure. I mean, I'm really excited to be talking about this topic on our first segment with you because it's actually kind of a departure for Greenpeace. We've never done this type of work before. But as we have been working to stop climate change over the past, I don't know how many decades, but getting increasingly more urgent, we've come to the realization that to fix climate change, like so many other issues, you have to look at the root causes of why change isn't happening.
Right, right.
And the root cause that we thought that we could maybe have some influence on is the way that our democracy operates. And for us, that's two pieces. One is getting people into democracy, so making sure that people have the right to vote and that they turn out to vote and that they feel like their voice matters.
Right, the basics,
And the second part is getting the money out of politics so that our corporations and the wealthy 1% don't have a disproportionate influence over the outcomes.
Huge. I am so loving this concept.
So one of the ways that we're hoping to do that is to use fossil fuel money as an example, and obviously the example that most impacts climate change. And we've asked the presidential candidates to sign a pledge to fix democracy, and as part of that, support voting rights support solutions on campaign financing, and to prove their support right now by saying that they're not going to take any more money from the fossil fuel industry in this campaign.
Yes! Like I just want to do like a little dance, a little happy dance. I love the idea. I'm hoping. Did I read that Martin O'Malley may be the first to sign the pledge?
Well, actually, Bernie Sanders has signed the pledge, so we have
first
signer.
Oh, yay!
We're thinking Martin O'Malley, we're hoping Martin O'Malley might be next because we know he has such a strong record on climate and environmental issues.
Okay.
So we see no reason why he shouldn't sign this pledge. And we're also hoping to get Hillary Clinton to sign this.
Well, I have to say, in reading up on this and getting prepared for our fun segment, I noted that, you know, Hillary Clinton, in what you guys have written, Hillary Clinton is number three. Of all the candidates, the third I don't know if I'm saying this right, but she takes money from fossil fuels, and she's like the third in I'm not saying it right. Please tell me.
No, we have – there's so many different ways to track fossil fuel money, right? So depending on how you track it, you come up with different results. But she is one of the top three beneficiaries of contributions from oil and gas employees.
Thank you.
And that is after Jeb Bush and Ted Cruz. So she's number three.
Yeah.
And obviously, a lot of money flows into these campaigns through lots of different sources, through front groups, through super PACs. Some of it is traceable, some of it is not traceable. And we can't, you know, it's difficult to cut off every avenue that the money has. But by standing up and saying, I'm not going to take money, like I'm going to, you know, disassociate myself from these lobbyists, I'm not going to take money from fossil fuel companies, you know, and I'm not going to be, you know, sitting down with these executives and letting them influence my campaign. I feel like that would be like a really strong start for Hillary to make that pledge.
Well, it would be a deal breaker for me. I would feel really good. There's other issues with Hillary that I would like to see her really disavow Monsanto from her campaign. But, you know, I don't know how deeply they are involved at this point, but it's not made me comfortable. At any rate, it's great. So, aside from, like, overturning Citizens United, which I think in the letter you're asking them to please do in order to help remove the influence and money from politics, you're giving them a very specific way to start. Just start right now with fossil fuel money.
So we see fossil fuel money as a kind of example. So it's not just fossil fuel money that's the problem. There's also, you know, all kinds of corporate and wealthy 1% money that is getting in the way of change. So, you know, we're working with a broad coalition of other groups, such as the NAACP and Public Citizen, as part of the Democracy Initiative. And through all of that work, we hope to emphasize it's not just fossil fuel money that's the problem. It's just a place where they can start.
Right, right. And of course, that would be a natural Greenpeace emphasis, right?
Right, exactly. And something that our supporters care about very deeply.
So the letter's gone out. I have the letter in front of me, and there's a lot of folks, Greenpeace, 350.org, Center for Biological Diversity, Climate Justice Alliance. The Green Divas have to be on that letter.
We would love to have you. We would love to have you sign the letter.
Well, I'm in. I'm on board. And we want this segment also to help people understand how they can take action. So let's tell folks, what can they do?
Well, they can go to greenpeace.org and they can sign a petition asking the presidential candidates to take this pledge.
There you go.
And then hopefully in early February, we're going to be rolling this out to candidates beyond the presidential realm. So we'll be asking your congresspeople, your senators and representatives to sign the pledge as well. And there will be opportunities to join into campaigns that are going to be happening all over the country or to start your own campaign as well.
Wow. And there's a hashtag associated with this. So if you're like a social media addict like our dear Lynn, it's hashtag Fix Democracy. And
yes.
Let's start making noise. I am on board for this because I think it's really important personally.
Well, we think that this is an issue that could appeal to people all across the political spectrum, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat. You know, you want people to be making the decisions, the people who are going out there and voting, not the corporations, not the 1%. You want your vote to matter more. So, you know, if you're a Republican who, you know, doesn't believe in climate change.
Right.
Hopefully you would still want to be voting your conscience on those issues, not voting because that's the money that you've gotten from the fossil fuel industry.
It really,
so whatever your political beliefs are, getting money out of the system is good for everyone.
Right. It really is a nonpartisan issue. It's just an issue of democracy and going back to its roots, hopefully. So, wow, really great segment to start with, Molly. So, people, you got to go to greenpeace.org. Also, I think we'll have a post on thegreendivas.com with this segment and other information and links. But let's get active. Let's make this an election that matters, you know? They all matter, but I want to feel like I've done a little bit more. Thank you, Molly.
Thank you so much.
To get active and connect with other Green Divas and Green Dudes, visit greenpeace.org/USA. And of course, check out thegreendivas.com for more ways to live a deeper shade of green.
Okay, so this is a topic that we have not really talked about in depth. I'm sure it's been mentioned, but seriously, not enough. And this man did a phenomenal job on a film highlighting this issue. Michael Nash, he's a filmmaker and director, documentarian, obviously. But his film, Climate Refugees, the statistics are so stunning and the faces are so real. It puts a face on what's happening. And even though it was done a few years ago and it won like 100 awards or more, I don't know, it's like looking at all the awards and for good reason. You know, the things that he was talking about and sharing and telling us in this film are still extremely relevant and need to be told. And anyway, so I'm very happy to be talking to Michael. Hi, how are you?
I'm great, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Seriously, I just like looking at the trailer, I was almost like blown away. So the statistic back then, tell me again what it was, that how many people are being displaced already by climate change?
Well, there's tens of millions of people, and you know, there's people that, you know, have put these numbers could go as high as hundreds of millions in the next decades or so. But this is something that's happening now, and back you know, several years ago, we traveled to 48 countries in search of the human face of climate change.
Yeah.
Was there a human face? If there was a human face, what does it look like? Was there anything we could do about it?
You found a lot of them.
We did, and we found things that, you know, at that point, there really was not any documentation or any you know, well-researched data on the human face of climate change. And we found all sorts of things. We found things that we never even planned on having in the film.
Oh, okay. So what was the most surprising thing that you discovered?
Well, I think if you were really going to take a 10,000-foot look at this issue, you know, the whole climate conversation has always really been about the carbon issue and is man causing it or isn't he causing it, and which is really, you know, the cause of it, and we really kind of focused in on the effects of it.
Right.
And what we found was it's really all about water. There's too much water in some places, and there's not enough water in other places. And these shifting climatic changes are really wreaking havoc in many places around the world. And all these countries that we travel to, we found an intersection, a collision taking place in civilization where overpopulation, overconsumption, lack of resources, and a shifting climate are colliding with each other.
Right, so it's a...
And out of that collision, people are starting to are forced to migrate. It really comes down to Maslow's hierarchy. People need, you know, food, water, and shelter. And what's happening is they're running out of food and water in many areas around the world. And, you know, people have always migrated and been nomads and, you know, moved to where the food was or where the weather kind of,
right,
but never to these numbers. And what's really different is we live in a border nation society, so people are starting to cross borders and create conflicts.
Right, right.
We're so.
Well, yeah, and of course, you know, people are going to start fighting over resources. In fact, you know, but other than the fact that someone from one country is crossing a border into another. I mean, look at what's going on with Syria, and the Syrian issue does have a climate component, and I think you guys brought that out a bit in your film.
We did. You know, we really. I mean, if you look at the Middle East and the North Sahara and it's MENA, the whole MENA region, it's incredibly challenged. And I should say that when we did this film, the United Nations had not officially termed these people at this point, and they do not call them climate refugees. They call them environmentally induced migrants, and they came up with that term a couple of years ago. With great care of putting the term climate in front of refugees, it would challenge the Geneva Convention, and the numbers are going to be so vast that it could actually put stress and strain on a convention on something that's worked fairly well for politically and religiously persecuted people. But with Syria, yes, Syria, you know, is a, I mean, it's horrific what's happening there, but what really was part of the cause of it. I don't think you can say it was completely the cause of it. And one of the things that a lot of the scholars that we spoke about stated was, you know, there are going to be places, much like what has happened to Syria, where a shifting climate is going to be the threat multiplier that throws these people into a bad situation. So if you look at Darfur, which was, you know, a disaster several years back, Darfur was, you know, it was made out to be kind of a religious war, but what really started it was the shepherds from the north went to war with the farmers from the south for the last arable land.
Yeah.
And Syria had an extreme four-year drought, which caused all the people, or most of the people in surrounding areas, to move into the cities because they were starting to run out of water and food. And those cities were already, you know, and conflict and stress, and when you put people on top of people, the angst built and a civil war broke out. And I don't think you can say it was completely because of climate change, but climate change was, that drought clearly assisted in creating the situation that Syria has today.
Yeah, I mean, and it can't be helpful in areas that aren't even necessarily dealing with other conflict. I mean, you have island nations that are, you know, scheduled to disappear, you know, in a decade or two.
It's crazy. We visited some of those, and Tuvalu, for example, you know, it's the smallest country that gets a vote in the United Nations. It's truly paradise. And, you know, some of the islands have already gone underwater.
Wow.
And there's 10,000 people living there. And Tuvalu is a very interesting thing because Australia basically has already said they're not going to take them. New Zealand has opened up the doors to them. But when you really dig into the document, it's more of a work program. They don't want to take anybody under or over 45 years old. They want to bring people in, you know, that can bring value.
Not helpful.
From a work standpoint.
Well, I'd be stuck. I'd be on a boat somewhere, you know.
Yeah. We interviewed a grandmother who, you know, was over 45 years old, and she was, I mean, it was sad. She was like, you know, I'm just going to have to stay here, I guess. And the other thing is, you know, their parents and grandparents are buried there. A lot of them don't want to leave their culture and their heritage. It's more than just a group of people kind of picking up in search of food and water. It's they're leaving everything that they've known behind, and you know, most of them don't want to leave.
I can imagine. I honestly, it would be just so. All of this, you saw a lot of heartache and difficulty and hardship. Were there encouraging moments? Were there inspiring moments? And you know, what was the most inspiring thing or encouraging thing that happened to you in the process of making this film?
everywhere we looked, there was, you know, I mean, when you look at these people's faces, you really, you can see how resilient the human spirit and soul is. And, you know, we tracked major cyclones and storms, and we ended up, you know, to give you an example, we were in the Sundarbar region of Bangladesh when Cyclone Siddur hit, and, you know, within a day, a million people were, you know, displaced and 10,000 people perished. And,
wow.
And we interviewed, we talked to those people after that, and I remember there was this one boy, as we were getting back on the boat to kind of head out, he came up to me, and he, and we speak about this in the film, but he said, you know, I hope that you'll go back to America and tell them that, you know, we need their help, and, you know, my friends and my family. And, I mean, here's a kid that, you know, probably mm-hmm. should be playing soccer, and not worrying about the survival of his friends, and but he does, and it's, you know, it's interesting because I do a lot of work in L.A. with people who are really trying to take the whole green movement and just the world that we're going to live in and the litigation and the mitigation and the adaptation of, you know, what happens when tens of millions of people start to relocate for food and water, and is there a better way to kind of explain this to people than creating eco-horror films?
Yeah.
And, you know, I always used the line, if Martin Luther King had started his march with "I have a nightmare" instead of "I have a dream," how many people would have followed that march?
Right.
So I think we have a responsibility to, you know, the generations to come to, you know, wrap our arms around this and really figure out the best way to move forward in a long-term sustainability issue. And there's a lot of, you know, great companies that I've met that are doing wonderful things around the world. And I look through this with a, you know, set of optimistic lenses. It's, we're going to live in a little bit of a different world, but you know, the world's not going to end. We're just going to have to come together a little bit more.
Well, you really did a great job. Literally, there were many shots just, you know, of the faces, and I think that was probably on purpose. There, you did create this clear and diverse image of the face of climate change. And I honestly think it's one of the least under, it's an underreported issue right now.
It is an underreported issue. You know, it's interesting. We screened at over 1,000 colleges around the world, and you know, the academics really kind of get this. The first test screening that we ever did was at the House and Senate, and
that's interesting.
It was really one of the first, I think, climate films that where the Republicans actually, they embraced it. I mean, many, you know, congresspeople and senators came up to me and they were like, listen, this is really interesting. You know, we never even, like, looked at it from this standpoint.
Right, right.
And, you know, and then you have the Pentagon that, you know, is now preparing for climate and resource conflicts around the world. So
yeah,
it's something that we need to put some really intelligent mind on and figure out the best way kind of through this.
Well, I'm glad your mind is on it, and I thank you for this film. Is there any new sort of relevant projects coming up that we might want to know about?
There is, and I can tell you that, you know, we if anybody who's listening, they could go to climaterefugees.com, and
yes,
you know, you can learn some stuff about it there. And we're in conversations right now with a sequel that we're talking about possibly shooting.
Great.
And, you know, there's just a lot of great people in Los Angeles and around the world who are really trying to figure out the best way to, and I'm speaking as a filmmaker or as a storyteller,
right,
you know,
right,
to get this message out. But hopefully we will start, you know, the sequel sometime in the next year, and looking forward to that.
Well, we're behind you 100% and do whatever we can to support that project. So thank you for staying on this subject. I'm sure you have done plenty of other things in between, but we're particularly interested in this one. So I appreciate your time, Michael, and hopefully we'll get to talk to you soon.
Well, thanks. And I'm a big fan of Green Divas, and you guys keep on doing what you're doing.
Thanks, Michael.
You've been listening to the Green Divas Radio Show. Be sure to look for this and other Green Diva Network podcasts on iHeartRadio, Stitcher, iTunes, Swell Radio, and Spreaker. Get social with the Green Divas on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Pinterest. Subscribe to the Green Divas YouTube channel to watch them in action. And for all the latest good green news, visit thegreendivas.com. That's THE greendivas.com.